It was a sheer cliff at the end of a barren plain in the middle of a island no one had ever heard of. And to that cliff at that time and that place, soldiers of the 307th Infantry Regiment, United States Army 377th Infantry Division, had come to do battle. On that tiny island, two great nations found themselves at war. As they came over the top of that 400-foot cliff, the soldiers' combat regiment team of the 307th Infantry found themselves facing a barrage of machine gun fire, artillery fire, and direct mortar fire. And soon there was one soldier left. He didn't carry a gun. He carried a medical bag. And in the face of an enemy counterattack against an entire regiment, he methodically treated and lowered to safety over 75 of his wounded comrades. For his actions that day, and for later actions on that island, he received the following citation from a grateful nation. Private First Class, United States Army, Medical Detachment, 307th Infantry Division, 307th Infantry Regiment, 77th Infantry Division. Through his outstanding bravery and unflinching determination, in the face of desperately dangerous conditions, Private First Class Desmond T. Doss saved the lives of many soldiers. His name became a symbol throughout the 77th Infantry Division for outstanding gallantry above and beyond the call of duty. Our topic this morning is called to greatness. And I ask you, what is your name remembered for? What do you stand for? And in that moment that every person will ultimately face, the moment or two that defines an entire life, a career, a series of choices, sacrifices, and achievements, what cable of character are you weaving? What decision will you make? It will not be a decision based on the moment. It will be a decision based on a lifetime of choices. From the earliest moments of our lives, we are faced with opportunities to choose. My grandmother once told me, habit is a cable. We weave a thread of it every day until at last it becomes so strong we cannot break it. In school, the decision to be honest on exams or not. In practice, the decision to go back and maybe do a little retroactive doctoring on charts or not. The decisions that we make in patient care. Each one of these decisions, the decisions that lead to a character of integrity and courage, are a cable woven from the youngest and earliest points in our lives until it becomes so strong we cannot break it. Private First Class Doss, on that cliff that day, did not suddenly decide to be brave. He made that choice from the first moment of his association with the U.S. Army when he was drafted. He had the courage to say, my religious convictions prevent me from carrying a weapon. He had the courage throughout training to put up with insults and jeers from his peers. He had the courage time after time to move forward under heavy enemy fire with no weapon in hand, unarmed, in the face of the enemy, to save lives, to fulfill the greatest commission, that others may live. And so when it came to that day on a 400-foot sheer cliff face, the decisions that he had made throughout his career ultimately and inevitably led him to do what he did. And 60 years later, shortly before he died, I had the privilege of seeing him. There is a tradition in the United States military that a soldier, airman, or sailor, or marine that wears the Congressional Medal of Honor is entitled to a salute regardless of rank. So as I came to attention and I saluted that man, he reached into his breast pocket and he pulled out a beautiful little blue and white ribbon. That one moment that has defined his life, living and dead, was the result, I submit to you, of a series of choices. Let's open the Word. Matthew chapter 27, verse 22. Pilate saith unto them, What shall I then do with Christ? The story of this young man begins in the city of Seville, where a man by the name of Marcus Pontius, a renegade Spaniard who threw aside his loyalties to home and country to fight for the legions of Rome, left the plains of Spain, joined the Roman legions, and rose through their ranks to become a general. He was brilliant. He helped the Romans complete the conquest of Spain, and as a reward received what to the Romans was their equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor. It was a special ceremonial javelin called a pilatus. Well, he was so proud of that award that he changed his name to Marcus Pontius Pilatus, which we have today anglicized to Pilate. He had a young, ambitious son, also with stars in his eyes, who thought that if it worked for Dad, he'd try it himself, joined the legions, headed east to fight on the frontier in Germania. Fought brilliantly in the German campaigns, and when the peace was won, he headed south to Rome. Rome, the great capital of the world, is a place where dreams were made. In that beautiful city, on its seven hills, he did find his dream and the fulfillment of his ambition. A young lady by the name of Claudia, only 15 years old, he met her, he fell in love, and at their wedding ceremony, her grandfather showed up, Augustus Caesar, great emperor of Rome. So young Pontius Pilatus had really fallen upstairs, married into the royal family, and as a wedding present, Augustus gave him the procuratorship, the governorship of one of the Roman colonies in Judea. He was so happy with his award that he raced at once to Caesarea, left his young bride behind, and moved into the imperial palace in Jerusalem. Now, the award of Judea shows us that Augustus didn't think so much of this ambitious young Spaniard because it was, at the time, one of the most troublesome of the different Roman provinces. At least five predecessors had learned that it was extremely dangerous to be a governor in Judea. It took courage. It took skill. And it took discretion. Well, Pilate clattered into Jerusalem at night, holding aloft the personal standard of Tiberius, the Roman eagle with the words underneath, SPQR, Senatus Populus qui Romanus, the Senate and the people of Rome, and the city of Jerusalem went mad. Freedom-loving Jews decided, and based on their religion, and of course the Ten Commandments, that they could not have this idol, this symbol, inside their holy city. The city rioted for 3 days. And when it was finally done, Pilate had to take the standard outside of the city and re-enter the town. Well, a couple of other times, Pilate found himself the butt of conflicts with the Jews. He had to back down on both occasions. And this brings us to the morning twilight of an April Friday in AD 31. I can best tell the story in dialogue drawing from a book called The Lucifer Diary, written by a good friend of mine. Pontius Pilate, who has been dreading the Passover weekend anyway, is roused by shrill voices that fracture the dawn. A centurion reluctantly steps to his bedroom door and knocks discreetly. "Excellency, I'm afraid there's trouble. The Hebrews have a man they want executed today. Something to do with their peculiar beliefs. There's a huge crowd and it's growing. What do you wish me to tell them?" Fuming, the youngish-looking governor thrashes loose from his linen sheets and sits up, his dark hair tangled from a restless night, his black eyes snapping. "I'd like to tell them to go burn," he replies, "but we'll have to listen to their twaddle. Tell them I will be there in an hour and have the chambermaid start heating water for my bath." The huge crowd is boisterous as they wait. They vent their frustrations on their prisoner, who has taken quite a battery. He says nothing, just absorbing the punishment. Presently there is a stir. A judge's seat is set up on the raised hump of paving stones outside Pilate's palace, and moments later, the governor strides out and takes his place on the curule chair. He is anything but happy, and his manner is curt. "Well, what is it? What is your accusation against this man?" Turn to John chapter 18, verse 29. Let's pick it up in the Word. John 18, 29. Pilate went out unto them and said, "What accusation bring you against this man?" At this point, Pilate is acting exactly like a Roman judge, which is one of his jobs as governor, as procurator of Judea. His job is to hear capital cases. One of the institutions of Roman government was that the conquered and occupied countries did not have the power to carry out a death sentence themselves. All death sentences had to be approved and executed by the Roman governing authority. So having convicted Jesus, the Jews had to bring him, the Sanhedrin having found him guilty to be punished by death, had to bring him to the Roman governor for the death sentence to be approved and to be carried out. So Pilate takes the seat of judgment, sits down, and demands to know what accusation is being brought against Jesus. And let's turn to another gospel now. We get a slightly clearer version of the story in Luke chapter 23, starting with verse 1. Luke 23, verse 1. And we pick up, as the Sanhedrin has found Jesus guilty, the whole multitude arose, led him unto Pilate. Why? Again, because Pilate was the one who had to carry out the death sentence. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to" who? "To Caesar," saying that he himself is Christ. What? A king. You see, Pilate, as a Roman governor, could care less that Jesus has declared himself to be the Messiah. That is a religious infraction, has nothing to do with Roman law, and is not likely punishable by the death penalty under Roman law. So what the Jews have done is to bring not a charge of being a false Messiah, but a charge of being what? A rival king to mighty Augustus Caesar, a charge of sedition, which is punishable by death in the Roman Empire. In fact, what they have done is to appeal to everything that Pilate both loves and fears. The Roman authority that protects him, that gives him scented sheets, a beautiful palace to live in, on a spectacular hill, spectacular view of the city called Mount Zion, that same authority can also send Pilate to the dungeon and possibly to the death cross himself for failing to deal with a charge of sedition. Why? Remember who's on the throne back in Rome. His grandfather, Augustus Caesar, is absolutely stark raving nuts. Paranoid does not even begin to describe the problems this man has. In fact, one Roman consul's mother was executed. The man's name was Fucius Geminus. His mother was executed for weeping at his funeral. He had been executed for treason. There were over 52 prosecutions and executions for treason under the reign of, Augustus, but Tiberius Caesar. So what the Jews have done is to bring the one charge that is guaranteed to get Pilate's attention as a Roman judge, as a Roman governor. Notice, however, that the charge they are bringing before Pilate is not the one they convicted him on in their court of law. Nonetheless, this is the charge that they are trying to get him executed on. And if you go back over to John, you will see that Pilate does not take this charge very seriously. John chapter 18 and verse 31. Having heard the charge of sedition, despite its explosive and inflammatory nature, Pilate obviously does not take the charge seriously, because in verse 31, he tells the Jews, "Take ye him, take Jesus, and judge him according to your law." In other words, charge him on the false Messiah claim. Do not bring the sedition charge to me. Well, there's a momentary huddle and a little babble of quiet voices, and the Jews come back and they say, "It is not lawful for us to put any man to death." Now let's go back to the Lucifer diary and pick up the story and dialogue. "Excellency, we can't execute this man. This is a capital case, and Roman law does not permit us to execute anyone." A capital case? You want me to just sign his death warrant? Just like that? He turns disgustedly and goes inside his judgment hall, leaving the mob to mill outside. "Centurion, bring the man to me. I will examine him in here." Acting as judge is one of his duties as governor, and Pilate has heard many legal cases, but as Jesus is brought before him, his eyes widen. He has seen the gamut: murderers, habitual thieves, even the false Messiah or two, for there have been many. And he expects to see the sullen face of a man who knows he's lost everything and is prepared to go down spitting into the face of hell. But this, nothing in his experience prepares him for what he now confronts. Jesus has been badly beaten. An eye is blackened, there are deep bruises on his face, and blood trickles from his nose. Yet he seems at peace. They tell me, Pilate says, that you claim to be the king of the Jews. Is this so? The term king is yours. My realm is not of this world. Instantly, Pilate seizes on what seems like an admission. A king? Might this be a sedition case after all? One can almost hear the wheels turning in his mind. Aha, so you are a king then. You could put it that way in human terms, but this earth is not my kingdom. I came to this world for only one purpose: to lead mankind to truth, and that is my realm. I am king of the realm of truth. For long moments, Pilate studies the bruises, the torn clothing, the evident beatings, and the calm serenity that has endured them all without remark. "No," he muses to himself, "this strange, quiet-spoken man is no threat to the empire. In Germania, where I once fought, there are wild barbarians, savage men, able to put a javelin clean through a horse. Now they are a threat. But this mild soul who calls himself the king of truth, Rome faces no danger from such as him." Abruptly, Pilate bolts for the door. "Order," a centurion commands. "His excellency has resumed the judgment seat." The words ring out across the paving stones. "I find no fault in him." innocent, te absolvo. A verdict that goes back on a legal doctrine that we still use today that goes back to the very morning of human history. It's called res judicata. Once a case has been tried, you can't reopen it. You can't retry the accused for a murder they have been acquitted of. How many people here are familiar with the doctrine of double jeopardy? What Pilate has done as a Roman judge is enter a verdict of acquittal. And that should have been it. Innocent, set the prisoner free. But that bright young man brought to the moment that would define the rest of his life, would define him throughout the ages. After a lifetime of sacrifice and ambition and success, a bright young governor with the entire power of the Roman Empire at his back, Pax Romana, peace where Rome said, when Rome said, because Rome said so. A young man on the seat of judgment with the 15th, 23rd, and 37th legions at his back. Having entered a judgment, having made a decision, found that cable of character that he had weaved of backing down, not following his convictions, of negotiating what he knew to be morally right. That cable of character ultimately bound him into second guessing his own soul, into negotiating for the life of deity itself. And at the end of that horrible day, as he signed a death warrant that sent the Lord of creation to the cross, instead of using his hands to free Jesus, as he should have done, he instead washed. Who are you today? And what is your mission? You are not Christians. You are Seventh-day Adventist Christians. You are special people at a special time with a special message. Your heritage is one of faith and action. The founders of this church, the people that came up with the beliefs that we share, the people that created the belief system that brings us all here today to share a common faith, were younger than just about everybody in this room. J.N. Andrews, for whom Andrews University is named, 15 years old in 1844. Ellen Harmon, 17. James White, who would one day become her husband, 22 years old. Uriah Smith, 12. His sister Annie Smith, who wrote many of the songs in your Seventh-day Adventist hymnal, 16. That is your heritage. A heritage of young people with belief and courage and a cable of character that led them on the morning of October 23, 1844 to ignore the jeers of the world and to keep digging for truth. The kind of character that would allow an Adventist pioneer walking down the street, heckled by a neighbor who said, "Oh, brother, are you still here with us on this earth?" To respond, "No, brother, I am in the land of the dying, but soon I'll be in the land of the living when Jesus comes back." What kind of character are you weaving today? I know it's time to go. There is much more I would share with you this morning. But as I leave, I'd like to leave you with words from your heritage, from a young lady who at the age of 17 had the courage to keep on going. "Dear youth, what is the aim and purpose of your life? Do you have dreams that you dare not mention, that you may one day sit at the summit of intellectual greatness and help to enact laws for the nation? There is nothing wrong with these aspirations. You may, every one of you, make your mark. Aim high and spare no pains to reach the standard." Dear Lord, it's a beautiful Sabbath morning in a beautiful place. We go forth to other worships, to home, and to a week that will be filled with challenges and opportunities. Help us to remember that you are the source of our strength, that you are always calling us to greatness. Help us to make the choices today that, when the true test comes, will help us be worthy of you and to not fail. In Jesus' name, amen.